61. Who the hell is Zion Lopez? Zig asked.
Drug dealer, small time, Nola explained, quickly telling Zig about her visit to Zion's cousin, the Oscar, the Grouch mask, and what she found on the minion cam.
As the shower continued to run and Prince continued to sing about an elevator bringing us down, Zig stepped out, put on a shirt, and took a seat on the closed toilet.
I assume you don't think this is about some petty drug deal, he asked.
Mint didn't smoke, much less do drugs. More important, Zion was a runt, Nola explained. Kid like that doesn't give orders, he takes them. From someone bigger, or at least smarter.
And you think that was the Reds?
Nola shook her head.
The Reds show because someone pays them to show. They're hired guns. Specialty is cleanup.
Zig thought about that. At Grandma's pantry. All those sedatives and opioids. Could Zion, or his boss, be the one who told you about Grandma's pantry?
Colonel Wantley.
Wantley's a tool bag.
I'm sure he'd be thrilled to hear your assessment. Anyway, the opioids,
this isn't about opioids. Stay with the Reds.
I told you. She kept asking me about Black House. Is that where Mint?
You said you found his account.
When I logged in, two people were already there, she said, mentally replaying the avatar of the Hispanic soldier with close-set eyes. I think one might have been Zion.
And the other was the Reds?
Nola made a face. She didn't think so. But that was the question, and the reason she came here. Whoever was in Mint's account, they were using his avatar. The voice was robotic, impossible to ID.
So that second person, either they were having their own private meeting with Zion, or they were doing exactly what I was, hacking into Mint's account, trying to figure out what's really going on.
Well, if it makes you feel better, it wasn't me, Zig insisted.
No tongue to his incisor. Truth.
That wasn't my concern.
Zig looked up, his eyes narrowing.
You think it was your brother?
She forgot how quick he was. Nola stood there, the Prince song giving way to the spin doctors singing about a pocket full of kryptonite.
Nola?
We're hiding in a bathroom and playing old 80s songs just to avoid him.
If you think Roddy was the other person in Mint's account, how did the Reds know to come here? She asked.
Excuse me?
Last night, they went to Zion's house and slit his throat. Today, they showed up here gunning for you. How'd they know you were working the case?
Maybe they saw me at the funeral.
Or someone from Dover told them.
Maybe.
Though what about the timing of their attack?
They were about to kill you and your employee,
Andy.
They were about to kill you and Andy. Then Roddy got here just in time. Saved you all.
What a hero.
I thought the same. When I asked Roddy, he seemed shocked by the accusation. And I hate to say it, but I believe him.
That's a mistake.
So you think Roddy, you think he's playing puppet master? That he found Mint's Black House account, then set this whole thing up?
And then what?
That he brought in the Reds and sent them after me, somehow hoping it would flush you out of hiding?
No offense, but when Roddy burst into the funeral home, he's the one who shot Sebastian.
Did he kill him?
He shot him in the face!
I'm not saying he's some criminal mastermind or that I have the full picture yet, Mr. Zigarowski. But I guarantee you, you don't know who he is at his core.
Then let me tell you what I do know. Your friend Colonel Mint, on the night he was killed, he wasn't eating alone at that steakhouse, was he?
He was having a private sit-down with another old friend of yours from Grandma's pantry, Rashida Robinson.
In my experience, Nola, people don't have secret dinners behind their wife's back unless they have something that's worth keeping secret.
Colonel Mint was a good man.
He also cheated on his wife and was a decorated soldier who tried his best to act with honor, something rare these days.
I'm not
judging him. I'm just trying to save your life, Zig insisted, careful to keep his voice lower than the music. At Dover, I saw Mint's files, his medical examiner report, his death certificate. Both were altered. Colonel Whatley's been fighting to keep things quiet. I told you, Whatley's a tool bag. I'm not disagreeing. But here's the thing he's right about. Years ago, there was a break-in at Grandma's pantry. Alarms went off, investigative teams arrived, and as artist in residence, you raced in to do a painting. But something went wrong, didn't it? The bad guys got nabbed, yet someone still swiped something from the government's secret warehouse. If we knew who it was, we would have had them arrested. I'm sure you would have. But right now, for some reason, people are showing up dead. And in case you haven't noticed, whoever's behind this seems pretty damn focused on your old grandma's pantry crew. You, Mint, Rashida, some guy named Elijah King. It's not a long list, Nola, and you're right at the top of it. Mr. Zig, we really have to go, Roddy shouted from the main sanctuary. At the sound of her brother's voice, Nola turned, her wrist bone smashing into the sink. A shock of pain ran up her arm. She cursed herself, hoping Zig didn't see it. Be right there. Getting out right now, Zig called to Roddy as the spin doctors gave way to a radio ad where someone was trying to sell cars by talking at light speed. Staying focused on Nola, he whispered, You're worried it's him, aren't you? That Roddy, that your brother has a hand in this? Nola stood there, waiting for Zig to say something else, or ask the same question in a different way, which he always did when faced with silence. But for once, he just sat there on the toilet, elbows on his knees, waiting for her answer. Mr. Zigarowski, you ever had your past come back and surprise you in the exact moment when you wished it wouldn't? Zig took a deep breath through his nose, elbows still on his knees. Every damn day. For a few seconds, the two of them stared down at the cracks in the tile floor, one of them a zigzagging hairline that ran from below the sink across the floor, all the way toward the window. Nola knew, when cracks were that long, there was no slip sheet installed on the concrete. Evidence of a deeper problem. Nola, what you just said about your past coming back, were you talking about Roddy or Colonel Mint? Nola thought about that, remembering what an army therapist wrote in her psych profile after she was reprimanded in Afghanistan for hitting her captain in the jaw with a plastic cafeteria tray. Suffers from RAD, reactive attachment disorder, seen in children who go through early neglect, incapable of forming attachments or loving relationships. Nola, you were close with Colonel Mint, weren't you? Mongol, Faber, Stettler, Ticonderoga. I didn't sleep with Mint, Nola blurted. Whoa. No, that's not what I was. Thump, thump, thump. Mr. Zig, we really need to go, Roddy called out, pounding on the door. Nola closed her eyes. It had been 2 decades since she'd heard her brother's voice. It sounded so different and perfectly the same. Seriously, Mr. Zig, Elijah said he's only around for another hour or so, Roddy added, referring to Elijah King, the last name from the back of Nola's painting, and the only person not accounted for from that night at Grandma's pantry. You should come with us. To meet Elijah, Zig whispered to Nola, getting up from his seat on the toilet. Mr. Zig? Who are you talking to? Roddy asked, fighting with the doorknob. He banged harder, the door now starting to shake. Nola darted for the slightly open window. Time to go. Roddy, give me a damn minute. I'm on a call with my wife. My ex, Zig insisted. As Nola reached for the window, Zig put a hand on her shoulder. In a blur, Nola spun, slapping his hand out of the way. Pure instinct. But what caught her off guard? She felt bad, which pissed her off even more. Undeterred, she pried her hands into the crack of the open window and gave it a sharp tug. There was a shriek. The window opened a bit more, then got stuck. Shit! She couldn't leave. "Mr. Zig!" Roddy shouted, banging harder, the door about to burst. Zig slid next to her, both of them grabbing the window's lower sash. "On three," Zig said with a glance. Later tonight, when the bodies were being carted away, Nola would think back to this moment and wish she'd said thank you to Zig. But right now, with Roddy pounding on the door, she had only one thought. Get out! Get out! Get out! With a violent tug, the window opened its mouth, fresh air licking their faces. Nola raised her leg, straddling the windowsill, halfway in, halfway out. "You don't have to do everything alone," Zig offered. He was wrong about that. The doorknob clicked with a new sound, Roddy picking the lock. "They didn't take anything out," Nola said.
"They what?"
Zig asked. "Grandma's pantry. The break-in. Whoever did it. They weren't trying to take something out of the warehouse," she said as she ducked down and slid outside. "They were trying to put something in." 62. St. Anthony's Medical Center, Elkton, Maryland. "Mr. Sewell, is that your wife?"
"No, do it louder," Nurse Sandy said.
"Mr. Sewell, is that your wife?"
"Mm-hmm," Robert Sewell said, nodding in slow motion, his head barely bobbing, as though his chin were so heavy it was hard to lift his head.
Like many men in their 90s, Sewell had a face that puckered toward his lips, his blue eyes cloudy with cataracts and his jowls sagging like a hound dog's. After 16 years in a coma, muscle atrophy took the hardest toll. Still, there was a sweetness to him, reminding Wags of an interview where Angelica Houston said that when you get older, you get the face you deserve.
"That's my wife, Rochelle," Sewell said, his hand shaking as he pointed to the picture frame next to his bed. "We got married in
Toronto," Wags said.
"In Toronto," Sewell said.
It was the fourth time he'd been asked about the black and white photo, which showed him and his wife in their early 20s, both of them holding Cincinnati Reds pennants. As the nurse explained, talking about Sewell's wife was the surest way to give him a kickstart.
"My pretty bird," Sewell said,
smiling and revealing just a few bottom teeth that were left.
"Big baseball fan. Kept her own box score."
"The Reds were her team?" Wags asked, also for the fourth time.
"Mm-hmm. Mad for 'em."
"Okay, try now,"
Nurse Sandy whispered to Wags. "What about this girl?" Wags asked, holding up a photo of Nola, again for the fourth time. Sewell's chin was still down by his chest. He looked up with just his eyes.
"Pretty bird, too," Sewell said, clearly excited.
"Her name is Nola Brown. Do you remember Nola coming to see you?" Sewell stared at the photo, his eyes slowly drifting sideways. Four times now, this was where he petered out, never able to verbalize an answer. Wags eyed the scar on his left temple. According to Sewell's file, he had what they called a penetrating injury. A pointy branch had stabbed him through his frontal lobe on his left side, which explained why his language was so impaired. For the first time, though, his smile was still on his face.
"Do you remember her coming to see you?" Wags repeated.
"He's really trying," Nurse Sandy said. "It's just hard for him to..."
I saw her," Sewell blurted.
"You did? That's wonderful," Wags said.
"That's wonderful, Mr. Sewell," the nurse corrected.
"Do you remember anything she said?" Wags added.
"Mm-hmm," he said, nodding.
"Great! That's great!"
"Mm-hmm,"
he repeated, his hands starting to tremble, then his chin. His head was now trembling, too.
"Please, Mr. Sewell,
If you know what Nola said.
He nodded, excited to help, though the trembling was getting worse. He stopped looking at Wags, his gaze sliding diagonally down, unable to hold eye contact. But he was still fighting to get the words out.
You sure he's okay?
Wags whispered, again eyeing his scar.
He doesn't look so good.
Nurse Sandy took Sewell's hand in her own. She'd been at this long enough to know what he needed. Sewell stuttered, looking pained and frustrated, like the words were stapled inside his lips. Sandy held his hand tighter, rubbing a small circle into his wrist. He reacted immediately, looking her way, blinking, pleading. Just as quickly, he was gone, staring into the distance, his eyes empty like no one was home.
He needs a break, Sandy said, still rubbing his wrist. Maybe you can come back tomorrow or later in the week.
For Wags, it should have been a relief. She'd been traveling all day. Time to get back to her life. She did have a life, she told herself, and a boyfriend. If she was smart, she'd call him right now and make peace for standing him up last night. But as she took out her phone, no. She'd texted him twice this morning, plus left a cute voicemail. Meikle still hadn't bothered to reply. No way would she grovel. Still, as she thanked Nurse Sandy and headed out into the fluorescent-lit hallway, Wags wondered if she was doing that thing she was always scolding Zig for, spending time on someone else's life rather than her own. How many times had they had that fight? Wags yelling that Zig should stop surrounding himself with the dead, with ghosts from the past, and instead focus on the living. And yet here she was, picking at those same puzzle pieces Nola had left behind. Was that the reason she and Zig had stayed so close all these years? It was a question worth asking. Maybe, after the ass-kicking that life had given them, they were both finding safety in the same place. You don't have to think of your own problems when you're trying to solve someone else's. Or maybe that was all just psychobabble manure, and it was time to face the harsher reality, that the real reason Wags had spent the better part of the morning running hospital to hospital, or had the Bureau install a secure line in her house so at any hour she could help agents around the world find the one thing no one else could find, was simply because she loved it. Was that her real truth? That she loved it and was good at it? Shoving open the double doors at the front of the building and feeling a blast of summer heat toast her neck, Wags again checked her phone. A few messages from Zig. Still nothing from Meikle. Just call him, she told herself. Instead, she swiped back to the Babel Street map with Nola's first two stops. Two patients. Two paintings. Two victims of brain injuries. A simple pattern. But still a puzzle. Luckily, Wags knew how to find more pieces. We're getting warmer now, aren't we, Nola? Wags whispered, spreading her fingers on screen and pulling in toward the next stop on the map. Landenburg, Pennsylvania. Private residence. Not a hospital. Why'd Nola go there? It was a question worth asking.
63.
It was dumb to be mad at Zig. A waste of energy, Nola decided. Yet as she darted through the gravel pit along the back of the funeral home and finally reached the corner of the building, she was still mad, still annoyed, still kicking herself for letting Zig worm his way back into her.
Nola? A familiar voice asked. Behind her, from the back door. Nola froze. She knew that voice.
When did you... Why are you... What are you doing here? Roddy asked.
Run, she told herself. Only a fool wouldn't run. Though before she realized what she was doing, she was turning, following the sound.
You look scared, Roddy said, his hands in the air, a show of trust. At his waist, his gun was still holstered. Same with his police baton. He was trying to prove he wasn't a threat.
But as he turned his hands slightly, Nola spotted his knuckles, purple and swollen. No doubt, her brother was always a threat.
Nola, your hair looks different. Straighter.
He looked old, shorter than she expected, his face pointier, his ears bigger. Everything the wrong size, like going back to your childhood room and having to redo the math to make the proportions make sense. The only things that hadn't changed were his black eyes, mirrors to her own, though they were sunk deeper in his head than she remembered.
Weary.
Do I look that tired, too? She wondered. And then she was hit with a forgotten memory of when they were kids, in the LaPointe's house, a group of them sliding down the stairs as Roddy stepped on her fingers, digging in with his heel, pinning her in place and trying to make her cry. Instead, with her free hand, she dug her nails into his ankle, drawing tiny semicircles of blood. There was blood here as well, though he'd clearly tried to scrub it clean from the chest of his uniform. On his sleeve, she spotted service stripes. 5 years, which is usually when you see a cop's gear start to look worn. Instead, Roddy's uniform looked sharp. Pressed pants, centerline crease still crisp, no worn spots at the pockets or where the gun and holster rub. To top it off, his badge was shined. He'd even polished and oiled his leather belt. Rare for a cop. Working hard to make detective? Or did someone teach him right? She couldn't tell, which unnerved her even more. Don't let him sucker you. Get out of here, she told herself, pivoting her foot in the gravel. Nola, please. Don't run. Just the sight of him stopped her. It stopped him, too. He had a stillness about him, a wounded stiffness in his voice. Something moved between them, brother and sister. A cobweb brushed away. You know why I'm here, Roddy said. Nola turned, refusing to answer. I wouldn't bother you, he added. But this, it's about her. Nola still wouldn't face him. From her spot at the corner of the building, she had a clear view of the side lot, of her car, a gray Dodge, 20 feet away. Not far at all. I know this is hard, Roddy added. The gravel shifted like quicksand. She stayed locked on her car. I don't blame you, Nola. With everything going on, I know you don't want to trust me, but I'm not who I was before. Neither am I, she shot back, stabbing him with a glare. That's it. That's all she was giving him. Fuck you, Roddy. Nola, don't. She began to run. Tearing open the door to her car and sliding inside, she started the engine and hit the gas. As the tires spun, kicking gravel in a pinwheel, she pulled away, Roddy chasing behind her, smacking the trunk of her car and running to his own car at the front of the building. She didn't have much of a head start. Roddy was still police. Once he flipped the lights on his cruiser, she'd have no choice but to... What in the f... Roddy shouted. Reaching the front lot, Roddy screeched to a halt, finally getting a look at his police cruiser. And its two flat tires. The puncture holes were clean. Back when Nola first arrived, she took a knife to them, just in case. On Roddy's right, there was a rev of an engine and a loud screech. Following the sound, he turned just as Nola's car swerved out of the lot and onto Route 1. 64. Tessa started with their credit cards. They were easy to check. Mint was the one who paid their bills, a detail that she, like many new widows, was suddenly ashamed of. But the payments were online, and her husband's password wasn't hard to guess. Huck Violet 1216. Same one he used everywhere. 6 minutes of clicking and scrolling revealed what she already knew, that Mint might have been dumb and reckless enough to once again be sleeping with Rashida, but he wasn't stupid enough to use his own credit card to pay for the one item that Tessa was now hunting for. Mint's second phone, the one OJ had found. and that his Dover forensic folks were now digging through. Back when Tessa first entered dental school, one of her professors told her, "If you don't know what's causing the problem, you can't fix it." There were answers on that phone, details about her husband. Yet during the hour-long drive home from Dover, Tessa couldn't help but wonder, would OJ share those answers with her? OJ and Mint had started their careers together, served together, and buried their fathers within 3 months of each other. Over a decade ago, OJ was one of the people they nearly asked to be Violet's godfather, though they eventually went with Tessa's flaky but wealthy brother. Family over friends, Tessa had insisted over Mint's protests. So would OJ tell her the truth about the second phone? Depends what was on it. Feeling her rage start to swell, Tessa slapped the laptop shut, plowed toward her husband's closet, and rifled through the sock drawer where he hid his watches and cufflinks. That's where she found the plug, an old micro USB, like the one used by their Kindle back in the day. This plug was new, though, as she suspected, from a burner phone. "You made a mistake keeping it here, Archie, which means you probably made more." It didn't take long for Tessa to pull apart the rest of his drawers, or the mini-safe where they kept their passports and birth certificates, as well as, at the very back, the plaster imprints of the kids' handprints from when they were born. The plaster was wrapped in pink and blue tissue paper, and as old memories flooded back, she hated her husband for ruining something that used to bring her so much joy. "Couldn't help yourself, could you?" Tessa muttered, gripping the charger and storming out into the hallway toward Mint's other favorite hiding spot, his home office. She was gritting her teeth so hard, a high-pitched note filled her ears. As she threw open the door to the office, the smell hit her first. A mix of old leather furniture and coconut oil from the fancy body wash she bought him for Christmas last. "Fuh!" Tessa shouted as the high back chair swiveled and moved. She wasn't alone. Someone was already here. Her first reaction was to raise a fist, to attack. But as she got closer, "Huck?" she started to ask, though the word didn't leave her lips. He was slouched in his seat, his teenage body curled like a magic lamp. In his lap was Mint's iPad, Huck swiping left, then swiping again, slowly, obliviously, as if he hadn't heard her come in, or didn't care. On screen was a childhood photo from Halloween. Huck, at 7 years old, dressed as Darth Vader. He'd dressed as Darth Vader 3 Halloweens in a row, loved wearing that massive plastic helmet everywhere, riding his bike, in his car seat, or even in the waiting room at the pediatrician's office. For protection, he used to say. To complete the Halloween outfit, Mint had dressed as Obi-Wan those same 3 years in a row, complete with Jedi robe and glue-on gray beard, though this photo was just of Huck, open hand pointed at the camera, pretending and believing that he was using the Force. If only life were that simple. Old photos. "Really going for the full melancholy, huh?" Tessa asked, kneeling down and wrapping her arms around the chair and her son, embracing them both in a massive hug. In the last year, Huck had gotten so big. He had his driver's license, had already been through his first and second girlfriends, and had even been grounded for drinking White Claws at Chris Weiss's house. But as Tessa knew all too well, when a parent dies, we all become kids again. Huck again swiped left, revealing a photo of him and his dad, Vader and Obi-Wan, lightsabers crossed in mid-fight. "Luke would have been the funnier costume," Tessa added. Huck nodded, his head shaky, fighting back both laughter and tears. "You know why he picked Obi-Wan?" "Because you asked him to?" Huck shook his head. "I asked him to be the Emperor. He liked Obi-Wan because Obi-Wan never loses. In the movies, he's the only Jedi. The only one who never gets beaten." "Doesn't Vader beat him?" "That's Obi-Wan's choice. He shuts off his lightsaber to help Luke. Same with Dooku, when he stupidly gives his lightsaber away because... Don't ask me to explain the prequels. But Darth Maul, Grievous, Vader, the Vader rematch? Obi-Wan rules them all. Tessa cocked her head, staring at the digital photo of her dead husband in his fake beard. That sounds like something your dad would like. Huck swiped through a few more photos, stopping on one of Violet dressed as a baby Princess Leia, which was quickly replaced by the Phillies baseball players she'd dressed as nearly every year since. Then a close-up of Mint, his smile so wide, the stickum beard was starting to peel away from his face. I remember that beard shedding all over our sofa, Tessa said. You were so mad at him, Huck replied with a laugh. Tessa nodded, fighting back tears of sadness and rage that were mixing as one. Come on. Let's find you something less depressing, she said, plucking the iPad from Huck's hands and sliding it next to the laptop. With a loving push, she edged Huck toward the door. Take your sister outside. Violet hasn't been out all day, which means she'll take it out on us tonight. Yet as Huck headed toward the kitchen, he didn't notice that right behind him, Tessa had tucked Mint's iPad and his laptop under her arm, waiting for a quiet moment when she'd be examining far more than her husband's old photos. 65. You have my number. Call me if anything changes, Roddy said into the phone. Especially if he stops breathing. He hung up. That was the charge nurse, Roddy explained from the passenger seat. With his tires still flat, they took Zig's car instead. She calls him Puerto Rican Andy, too. Says she knows him from the pickups he does when someone dies in that. Just tell me what she said, Zig interrupted, holding tight to the steering wheel, staring straight ahead as the highway blurred in front of them. He's still in intensive care, but his color's improving. She said it's a good sign. Unless, of course, he stops breathing, Zig replied. Roddy blinked twice. Oh, you're making a joke about my comment. To help yourself feel better. Zig glanced up at the rear view. Nearly 2 hours ago, they'd left the funeral home, following the narrow two lanes of Route 322 onto I-95. The entire time, Zig had been searching the highway for who else might be following. No doubt, the Reds were still out there. So was whoever hired them. And so was Nola. Roddy, can I ask you a question? Why are you really doing this? You mean going on this ride? Not just the ride. The fighting. The investigation. I know you're a cop. Police. Police. Sorry. I don't take offense, Mr. Can you please stop talking and just listen for once? I get that Nola's your sister, but even still. Until today, back at the funeral home, you hadn't seen her since you were 7 years old. You grew up. You built a life. You became police. From what you said, the way she took off, she came to the funeral home for a reason. For all we know, she heard the police report, and that's what brought her here, Zig said, still keeping her visit in the shower to himself. So the real question is, after all these years, why the sudden interest in her? Why now? Roddy sat there silent, which he did a lot. Do you know who you are, Mr. Zig? You mean a mortician? That's your job. I don't care what you do for a living or where you're from. I mean at your core. I was a bad kid growing up. I worked hard to turn that around. Or I'd like to think I turned that around. But other days, especially on hard days, don't you want to know, Mr. Zig? At your core, who are you? And you think connecting with your sister will tell you that? Like some magic answer? Roddy stared straight ahead, reaching to adjust the small AC vent, though it wouldn't quite open. Pressing his thumb into the plastic, he popped it back in place. Good as new.
At the funeral home. Your friend Andy. Why do you offer to die for him?
Excuse me?
Back in the sanctuary. I saw what you did. When the red-headed woman, Reagan.
How'd you know her name was Reagan?
You said it earlier,
Roddy insisted, though Zig could swear he'd kept that to himself.
It's just, when Reagan was about to slit Andy's throat, you said you would trade your life for his.
Those were your words, Mr. Zig, that she should let Andy go, that if someone had to die, she should kill you instead. Up ahead, an ugly metal structure rose in the distance, the arched turnpike toll bridge separating Pennsylvania from their destination in New Jersey. Zig didn't like bridges. He'd buried too many soldiers who'd jumped from them.
Mr. Zig, I can't name a single person who'd do something like that for me.
The car's tires began to hum as they crossed the bridge. In Zig's head, he couldn't help but start his own list, though it felt just as empty. He thought of his ex-wife, his daughter, and of course the person who saved his life 2 years ago, Nola. Glancing back at the rear view, Zig knew she had to be close. No way would she let them get to Elijah without trying to listen in and...
Check the glove box, Zig blurted.
What? Why?
Check the glove box, Zig repeated, feeling his pants pockets, shirt pockets, then the crevices of the seat. He knew Nola's tricks.
You think the Reds?
You think they bugged us? Unclear, Zig said, though it was just as fair a point. For the next few minutes, they combed through the car, the center console, the sun visors, the dome light, and yes, the glove box. He even pulled over, searching the outside and underneath.
Nothing. All clean.
Picking up speed, Zig checked the rear view again. There were only a few cars on the road.
It made no sense.
Back when Nola cornered Zig in the shower, she was clearly still working the case, still asking questions, still trying to figure out the truth behind Black House, the Reds, and whoever had hired Zion to pull the trigger on Rashida and Mint. Yet the more he thought about it, this case was working her. The speed that she ran out of there. Her hands were shaking as she tugged open the window, like her life depended on it. Roddy said the same, that she ran without even talking to him. For Nola, Mint's death was more than just a normal case. It was one that cut to something deeper, something from her past, something she'd rather keep there. Zig glanced over at Roddy, who sat calmly, his posture a perfect L-square. There were damp spots across the chest and arms of his uniform, where he'd scrubbed away the blood, but his shoes were still a mess. So were his knuckles, which were bruised and swollen, covered in a dozen red and purple cuts, each a tiny, screaming mouth. Zip could still picture Roddy sitting on the big redhead's chest, pounding Seabass in the face, pile driver after pile driver, with a savagery and ruthlessness that came far too naturally. From the moment Roddy first showed up, Zig thought his best bet was to keep him close. But what if that was wrong? The way Roddy exploded on Seabass was like a grenade, and only a fool keeps a grenade close. Nola's words echoed in his brain. You don't know who he is at his core.
What did she say? Roddy asked.
Zig turned. I'm not sure what
your ex-wife. In the bathroom.
When I was banging on the door, you said you were on the phone with her.
What did she say?
Ex-wife stuff. Nothing really.
It must have been important if you took the call in the shower.
Zig's eyes again slid toward Roddy, who was still staring straight ahead, palms down on his thighs, like he was sitting in church.
It was about our daughter, Zig replied.
The one who died. Zig didn't answer.
I'm not trying to pry, Mr. Zig. When we first met, I looked it up. The old newspapers, the obituary.
None of it listed a cause of death. This was the point where most people stopped talking. I found the old police report, Roddy added. It said your daughter was run over, that you and your wife were having an argument, and that your daughter ran outside and hid under your car. Roddy had part of the story, the police never knowing that for Zig and Charmaine, it was more than an isolated argument. They were having marital problems, made even worse when Zig found out that Charmaine was cheating on him. That's why Maggie ran out that night. To avoid the screaming, she hid under the car and eventually fell asleep. The report said when you realized she was gone, you jumped in your car to go find her, Roddy added. But as you backed up in the driveway, you accidentally... Listen, I'm just saying. I'm sorry it happened. That must have been... Roddy couldn't find the right words to finish the sentence. In 1 mile, take the exit for Route 130 on your right, a robotic Google Maps voice said from Zig's phone. Zig hit the gas. They were close. Mr. Zig, if today were a color, I'm thinking it has to be black or midnight blue. Anything else, Roddy? He thought about it. You think anyone's waiting for us at Elijah's? Zig tugged the steering wheel, heading for the exit. We're about to find out. 66. Reagan did stupid things when she was angry, and she was due for another right now. I need you to think good thoughts. You got a good thought? Reagan asked, frantically emptying a red and white Target bag, a few of the contents falling to the car's floor. Crumpled in the passenger seat next to her, Seabass gave a quick nod like all was well, but there was no hiding the pain. She'd reclined his seat to keep him out of sight and stretched a bloody beach towel across his chest. His mouth was a ground-up mess from where the bullet had pierced his cheek and kicked through his teeth. In dental terms, he had an LS3 fracture, involving the enamel and running all the way down to the pulp layers. Even worse, since the nerve root was exposed, it absolutely killed when cool air hit it. Like now. You're thinking of that woman in Peru, aren't you? Reagan teased, though she couldn't mask the irritation in her voice. Diagonally across the Target parking lot, she glanced for the second time at a gray SUV near the front of the store. Reagan had parked in one of the very last spots, but even from here, she could see two young sisters, around 4 and 9 years old, both of them with messy bird's nests of blonde hair, arguing in a mini civil war. Clara, sit still, the older sister scolded as the younger one squirmed in her car seat like Houdini in a straitjacket, just like Reagan's own sister used to. At the trunk of the SUV, their skinny, distracted mom was gabbing on her oversized cell phone, holding it away from her face like a teenager, which made Reagan want to storm across the parking lot and tear it from her hands. Breathe, Seabass said with a glance, reaching over the car's center console and cupping his giant paw of a hand over her own. You need a breath. It was his standard move. He'd used it last year in Montana when that security guard at the freezer company shot up their car, and in Brazil when Reagan got drunk and picked the wrong fight, and even back when they were junior enlisted at Fort Leonard Wood when that staff sergeant with the Arkansas twang put his hand on her ass and she reached for her gun. Will you stop? I'm fine, she insisted, slapping his hand away. 4 hours from now, when Seabass went down, this was the moment she'd go back to, hating herself for her reaction. Across the parking lot, the 4-year-old sister started crying, kicking wildly in her car seat, and now all Reagan could picture was her own sister all those years ago, and everything that went wrong on that night she'd never be able to take back. Reagan was stupid that night, too. Though not nearly as stupid as... Seabass again reached for her hand, not to calm her,
but for help. He was sinking in his seat, about to pass out. "Sebi, the girl from Peru," she shouted, tugging him upward to keep him from aspirating on the blood he was now coughing all over his own chest. His face was bone white, his eyes not focusing. She needed to be fast. Rule one in any ER, forget the pain, stop the bleeding. "Sebi, wake up," she exploded, rummaging through the shopping bag. "Look, I got you presents," she explained, pulling out a football mouthguard and a pack of Crayola rainbow modeling clay. As she opened the clay, she got a whiff of her childhood. Yanking off a hunk of yellow clay, Reagan stuffed it into the mouthguard. Ideally, she'd use dental cement to create a tamponade at the bleeding area and apply some pressure, like packing gauze into a knife wound. It'd also hold his teeth in place. But with no cement, modeling clay would do. "Sebi, come on," she pleaded. She pinched his wrist to wake him up. "On two, okay?" He nodded, still groggy. "One." She lifted the mouthguard, filled with clay. He opened his mouth. "Two." With the heel of her palm, Reagan stuffed the mouthguard between his lips. Seabass curled forward, twisting, squirming, electrified by pain. She grabbed his chin and his forehead, shoving his head backward into the headrest. As she forced him to bite down, bloodied yellow clay oozed between his lips like a human piping bag. Pressing his skull into the headrest, Seabass did everything he could not to yell, howl, or scream. He clenched his jaw tighter than ever, breathing hard through his nose with frantic huffs like he was in labor. For nearly 30 seconds, he swallowed the pain, pretending it wasn't there, leaning backward and biting down. He focused on an old memory, back when he first arrived at Fort Leonard Wood. He could do this. He had it, he told himself, his huffing getting softer and softer until, like a leaky balloon, he let out a high-pitched, indistinct wail that brought matching tears to both his and Reagan's eyes. "I can make more jokes about the Peruvian girl," Reagan said. "That's who you were thinking of, right?" He nodded over and over, his sad blue eyes staring straight up, like he was trying to will himself out of his body, out of existence, out of sight from the only woman he ever honestly thought about. "Reagan, Sebi, if the pain's too much, I can take you to a hospital." He shook his head, pointing to the other bloody mess, the bullet wound in his cheek. The swollen black slit was barely a centimeter long, but still stinging from all of Roddy's punches. It definitely needed closing. "Just finish," he said with a glance, Reagan quickly shaking the last items from the shopping bag, a pack of sewing needles and a spool of silk thread. In the movies, homemade stitches were made with fishing line, but as her dad taught her, fishing line unravels. If you want the knots to grab, you need texture. "Okay. In that fantasy with Ms. Peru, here's where she takes her top off," Reagan finally said, lowering the threaded needle to his cheek. "On two. One." Seabass grabbed the center console with one hand, the car door with the other. "Talk to me," he told her with his eyes. "Have we worn out the Peru bit? Or should I just tell you the 15 different ways I'm going to murder Zig and that runt cop who did this to you?" Seabass nodded, holding a pretend phone to his face. She knew what he meant. Their handheld GPS. Back when they ran out of the funeral home, Reagan put a tracker on Zig's car. "Where are they?" "Jersey," she said, pushing the needle into his cheek and looping it into a quick mattress stitch. "At a bar of all places." For the next 2 minutes, Seabass sat there, eyes shut, as Reagan made another few loops and pulled the thread tight. That's all it took. Compared to the mouthguard, the stitches were the easy part. Fighting to sit up in his seat, he lowered the sun visor, checking her work in the mirror. His face was bloated and swollen, but at least the bleeding stopped. He pointed to the GPS. "How far?" A small grin lit Reagan's face. She did stupid things when she was angry.
but so did Seabass. Not far at all, Sebby. She started the car. We'll be there in no time. 67. Wonderly Square, Pennsylvania. Nola wanted to draw, though now wasn't the time. Hitting the gas and weaving through the afternoon traffic, she blew past a 40-something dad in a minivan, no kids in back, blaring 90s hip-hop as he bounced to the beat. She was trying to put as much distance as she could between herself and Zig's funeral home. But that didn't stop her from drawing in her head. It was her brother Roddy who she mentally started to sketch, still kicking herself for letting him get so close. Careless. Another damn mistake. It was happening over and over, like she was a noob grunt again. Yet as she replayed the sound of Roddy banging on the door, just hearing his voice again, and then to be standing there face to face to finally see him. The deep-set eyes, the polished uniform, worn like a costume to make him look helpful and good. "You know why I'm here." Those were his words, the words of someone who wants something. She replayed it again. Roddy said this was about her. There was only one her. A trick. Had to be a trick. No way did Roddy know what Mint did for her all those years ago. The real reason she was so attached to this case. And then, to her own surprise, her mental drawing quickly shifted to Zig. Their little meeting in the funeral home bathroom. She didn't want to say it was good. She'd never give him that. But she had to admit, his concern, the panic in his lonely eyes. His hands were shaking as he tried to open the window so she could sneak out. She wanted to say there was something nice about not being in this alone, but she wasn't convinced of that. Maybe it was just that she knew, she absolutely knew, that even here, in a case that was making her far too emotional, Zig wouldn't screw her over. And she couldn't say that about most people. Turning off the main drag and down a narrow side street, Nola wove her way toward the back entrance of a long-dead strip mall that held the corpse of a hollowed-out Blockbuster Video, that became a 24-hour gym, that became a Spirit Halloween store, that finally became a place where, to judge from the scattering of beer cans and Red Bulls, local high school kids came to drink at night. Good sign. Kids know where there are no surveillance cameras. Pulling out her iPad, Nola opened the app for Black House and entered Zion's phone number. A digital hourglass appeared on screen, along with a single word. Locating. That's how she'd tracked the Reds in the first place, from when they grabbed Zion's phone. Back at Zion's house, after watching footage on the nanny cam, Nola had combed through his emails, home computer, and anything else she could find. It was there she noticed the Black House icon on his desktop, confirming her theory that back when she'd first logged into Black House, Zion was one of the two digital avatars she saw there. The question remained, who was the other? For a while, Nola thought it might be OJ or another investigator. But the more she thought about it, the way the two avatars logged off together, the more it seemed like it was someone Zion knew, like a friend or employer. Hoping to find the answer, she'd tried logging into Zion's Black House account. But unlike with Mint, she had no chance of guessing Zion's password. Still, the fact they each had their own login. Opening Mint's Black House account, Nola clicked the button labeled Contacts and entered Zion's name. Contact not found. She entered his email. Contact not found. She entered his phone number. A pop-up box appeared. One known associate. Connect Y N. She hit yes. On screen, a new pop-up appeared. Locating. Lazy, Nola had thought, rolling her eyes. Most Black House users were probably smart enough to disable their location services. But again, Zion was a runt, a moron, and completely trackable, assuming the Reds still had his phone. Across the Blockbuster, gym, Halloween store parking lot, a gust of wind rolled a stray beer can into a shopping cart turned on its side. On screen, the digital hourglass blinked. The word locating disappeared, replaced by signal unavailable. Nola re-entered the phone number, double-checking each digit. Signal unavailable. They know. Of course they know. The Reds weren't novices. Seabass got shot in the face. They either disabled tracking on the phone or tossed it. Undeterred, Nola reached into her pocket and pulled out a folded sheet of paper that was covered with phone numbers. Like most people, Zion paid his bills online. A quick search of his browser history turned up a T-Mobile account, which revealed all of Zion's incoming and outgoing calls over the past 2 weeks. There were nearly 50 in total, most of them late at night. Customers, Nola thought, remembering the stash of drugs in Zion's closet. Starting at the top, she entered the first phone number into Mint's Blackhouse account. Contact not found. Next number. Contact not found. It was the same, over and over. Nothing. 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 Until something. On screen, a new pop-up box appeared, with a little red triangle that had an exclamation point inside. Restricted access for XXX, XXX, XXXX. Subject flagged for confidential purposes. Contact DOJ's Special Identities Unit. Special Identities Unit. She'd seen it before. Whoever owned that phone number, she was supposed to stay away. But that was always Nola's problem. She was never any good at doing what she was supposed to. On the iPad, she opened a browser. It was the best part of finding a phone number. From there, it's not hard to get an address. 68. Grafton, New Jersey.
Who you looking for?
A female voice challenged. Zig turned, spotting a 90-year-old African-American woman with cannula tubes at her nose. They ran down off the edge of the bus bench she was sitting on to a portable oxygen tank that was bedazzled with pink rhinestones. On her face, to block the fading sun, were oversized Jackie O sunglasses that made Zig think he was in the presence of royalty. Just trying to find a bite to eat, Zig told her. Lady Rhinestone looked at him skeptically. It got even worse as she eyed Roddy's police uniform. Across the street was a food hall built into an old bus station, an artisanal ice cream shop, and a make-your-own pottery place called Every Clay is a New Clay. Each of them had a water dish for dogs out front. It was the same in cities from Seattle to Washington, D.C., to right here in Jersey. The arrival of whites in minority communities led to gentrification and dog dishes for everyone. Of course, if you went down the wrong block, some of the neighborhood was still rough around the edges. Let me guess. You're looking for Elijah, Lady Rhinestone said. How do you know that? Zig asked. You look the same as the other guy. Zig raised an eyebrow. Other guy? Ma'am? Was there someone else looking for Elijah? Up the block, two 20-somethings on electric scooters were riding in circles. Lady Rhinestone took a huff of her cannula tube. Last night. Handsome fellow. Looked like that young man who played Black Panther and Thurgood Marshall. He had a part in his hair, which, let's admit, is a crime for an afro. But he made it work. Zig and Roddy exchanged a glance. Colonel O.J. Wantley. He was here last night, though he never mentioned it when Zig was in his office. So you work here? Zig asked, spotting the apron she was wearing, embroidered with Every Clay is a New Clay. Sweetie, that's my shop. I'm the owner,
she said coldly, lowering her chin just enough to give him the stink eye above the rim of her sunglasses.
Yeah. No, that's what I meant. Forgive him. He's white, Roddy said.
It made the woman laugh.
If I could ask one last question, he added. The address we have. Elijah gave us his home address, but I think we might have it wrong.
You passed it, she said, pointing behind them toward the 20-somethings on the scooters. They were still riding in circles, though now, a block closer, past a refurbished 2-story red brick building that looked like a trendy bar. No dog dish in front.
He sleeps upstairs, Lady Rhinestone explained. Just be careful when you go inside. He's been known to shoot at white people.
Zig froze. I'm teasing.
That's humor.
Roddy offered her a fist bump. She took him up on it. Of course she did. When Zig first met Roddy, he wrote him off as a social misfit, but it was time to admit. From the funeral home, to finding Elijah, to tracking him here, over and over, Roddy's eyes never left the prize. Even if Zig didn't trust him, it was time to stop underestimating him, and to start using him. Zig headed for Elijah's, the summer sun fading in the purple sky.
She liked me better, because I'm nicer, Roddy said, running to catch up. You should laugh. That's a good joke.
Zig ignored it, eyeing the scooter guys who were still making circles, winding their way closer. There were other people on the streets, nearly all of them young 20 and 30-somethings, all of them with a professional veneer. This was a neighborhood on the rise, and Elijah was part of it.
I need your cop brain. Can we go back to Grandma's pantry for a moment? Zig asked.
You mean the break-in?
I've been thinking about it. What if instead of taking something out, well, on that night 5 years ago, what if someone was actually trying to sneak something in?
Roddy thought about that. The scooter guy's now barely half a block away.
Why would someone bring something in? That's the question, isn't it?
I'd bring something illegal, Roddy decided. A warehouse with security like that.
I'd bring drugs.
Drugs are one possibility. Weapons, too, Zig acknowledged. But thinking of all the antidotes they keep there, for smallpox, SARS, Ebola, what if someone brought in lesser versions of those to dilute the real stuff during an actual catastrophe?
Or maybe just to create doubt so the government orders even more, Roddy said, nodding over and over like he was enjoying himself.
If you really want to be destructive, bring a bomb inside. Blow up the warehouse itself.
Or blackmail it, Zig agreed.
Gimme 50 million or the whole place goes boom.
Zig stopped at the red brick storefront.
Opportunities, read the hand-painted sign on the front glass. In the bottom right-hand corner, in one of those trendy typographies that you instantly know is cool, but also somehow reminds you of the font of an eye chart, were these words. Proprietor, Elijah King. The fourth and final member of Mint's team.
69. Fair winds, Pennsylvania. Sabrina S. wasn't any help. Neither was Gina Castronovo, or Sherry Goldman, or the twins, Rachel and Julia Cohen. For hours now, Charmaine had been staked out at her kitchen table, using Facebook to track down cell numbers, making phone call after phone call to Maggie's childhood friends. As expected, the hardest part was the small talk, hearing that Sabrina S. and Leah were both married with kids. Pamela had gone back to school to be a physician's assistant. Jody was running for the local school board. And Melanie had started her own web marketing business. All of them in their late 20s. Hopes and possibilities spread out in front of them. While Maggie was forever 12. Forever a Girl Scout. It was no different with Caitlin Rose, who spent a solid 5 minutes explaining that she'd been teaching kindergarten and recently got engaged, though all Charmaine remembered about her was that her teeth always seemed too big for her mouth. "I met him online, of all places," Caitlin added with a gaspy laugh. "He wants a destination wedding, but I'm trying to convince him that everyone hates those couples." It was yet another cute story from yet another well-meaning young woman. But as Charmaine sat there, elbows on the table, hunched toward her speakerphone, there was actually something surprisingly satisfying, even reinvigorating, about hearing these updates and recaps. At first, Charmaine chalked it up to the afterglow of nostalgia, to hearing the girls' voices all grown up and trying to plot the course between now and then. Or maybe it was just her own dismal expectations. But to sit here and take in the contours of their fledgling lives, to listen to their stories and all the emotion packed into them, just the act of tracking them down and wondering where they've been, it made her feel like a parent again. And that, for Charmaine, was something glorious. "It's funny. You know what always makes me think of Maggie?" Caitlin asked, actually saying Maggie's name, a detail most shied away from. "Convertibles."
"You mean cars?"
"She took me for my first ride in a convertible, or rather, Mr. Z did after one of our scout meetings. White car, maroon top."
"Ford Mustang. Anniversary edition," Charmaine said, the smell of the leather interior, plus a musty scent from a leak quickly flooding her senses.
"I was 10, maybe 11.
He pulled up and told us to hop in without opening the doors. When he hit the gas and our hair started whipping everywhere, I honestly thought the car had a rocket and we might take off. He even used to do a countdown. 3, 2, 1.
Blast off, Charmaine thought, a heartfelt smile lifting her cheeks. Zig had saved years for that car. He'd wanted one since high school, then refused to buy it once Maggie was born. As a mortician, he'd seen too many overturned military jeeps and the closed caskets that came with them. It was Charmaine who pulled the trigger, sneaking off to the local Ford dealership and surprising him on his 40th birthday.
"He really let you jump in the car without opening the doors?" Charmaine asked.
"In and out, every time. He'd blast the Beastie Boys' Sabotage and tell us to pretend we were 70s cops."
Charmaine laughed with a snort, a swell of tears seeping out behind her eyes. That sounded like Zig, back when life was so easy, or at least before everything got so hard.
"Who's on the phone?" a deep voice asked behind her. She barely turned as Warren entered the kitchen, searching the fridge for a snack.
"Nothing. Work call,"
she pantomimed, waving him away and taking the phone off speaker.
"Again, Mrs. Z. Sorry I couldn't be more helpful about Maggie," Caitlin added. "My superstar's days were limited to Sabrina's horrible birthday party where she told us we were all fat."
"If it makes you feel better. She just had a kid who's making her miserable by refusing to sleep through the night."
"I don't wish bad on anyone."
For a half second, Caitlin paused.
"Except maybe her."
As Charmaine laughed, Caitlin added, "Back to superstars for a moment. Have you tried calling the Ainsleys? Their beauty supply place was in the same plaza."
Actually, GBS Beauty was one plaza over. Superstars was with Kubatai, that pack-and-ship place, and that...
Charmaine stopped, sitting up straight.
"Mrs. Z, did I lose you?"
"Yeah."
"No."
"I'm here," she insisted.
Yet as she remembered one last store in the Superstars Plaza, Charmaine had a brand new idea.
70. It was a card store, Card Kingdom, dedicated to greeting cards of all things. Nola didn't need a sketch pad to know something smelled.
Parked diagonally across the street, she eyed the storefront, which took up the ground floor of a two-story concrete thumb of a building sandwiched between a gas station and a skate park that was empty except for an elderly man sitting there with a little black dog on his lap. The neighborhood, just outside Philadelphia, wasn't bad. It just felt left behind. As for Card Kingdom, the front window held a giant Hallmark logo sticker that bubbled against the glass, along with an oversized Christmas present filled with faded rolls of wrapping paper featuring Garfield and the Smurfs. If Card Kingdom was trying to attract business, they weren't trying hard. Back during her early military training, they called it sizing up the building. Clear front entrance, single access point, standard locks. Most important, no cameras. If time were on her side, she'd do a full sweep, checking all the angles. But the way things were going, if someone beat her here... Kicking open the car door, Nola plowed toward the storefront. An actual bell rang overhead as she stepped inside, the smell of old paper wafting over her and bringing, in the midst of this, an actual good memory. Her teacher, Ms. Sable, taking her to the art supply store for the first time. Inside, Card Kingdom was nicer than she expected. Its four aisles of yellow, 70s-era, faux blonde wood display cases were old, but the greeting card seemed new, or at least not picked over. On her far right, the cash register was manned by a 20-something guy, thin eyebrows and delicate features, wearing a plaid flannel shirt and one of those gray slouchy beanie hats that looked ridiculous in the heat of summer, and instantly told Nola he was more fashion victim than threat. Scrolling on his phone, he barely looked up. Hoping to be quick, Nola wove through the narrow aisles, passing sections for birthday cards, anniversaries, get well and farewell, and even, as she turned the corner, a section labeled Dirty for Him, Dirty for Her. Scattered along the walls were formica shelves of snow globes, ceramic figurines, crystal animals, and every other useless knick-knack that a store like this sells to stay in business. But what caught her eye? Any Father's Day cards? Nola asked. Tomorrow, Beanie Hat said with a grunt, still phone scrolling. Nola made a note. Father's Day already passed. Strike one. At the back of the store, a vertical sliver of light revealed a back door that overlooked a small parking lot behind the building. She squinted, spotting three cars. For a store with only one employee. Strike two. Yet what caught Nola's eye more than anything else? There, along the right-hand wall, an elevator, polished steel. High-tech call buttons, state-of-the-art, like something you'd use for a fortress.